heralded as the coming great new lyric soprano of the Metropolitan Opera, Suzanne Fisher, a girl from West Virginia, has already reached the heights of fame abroad. She made her debut in Berlin at the Staatsoper in 1931 and remained there three successful seasons. This afternoon, she makes her American radio debut. Miss Fisher sings Depuis la Jour from Louise by Charpentier.
Thank you.
the magic key turns west again. This time out to Hollywood and Franchotone in a scene from his latest Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer picture, Mutiny on the Bounty.
Mutiny on the Bounty. Into those four words is compressed one of the most exciting stories in the history of the British Navy. Retold in Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer's magnificent motion picture, Mutiny on the Bounty. A page or two of which we show you now. In 1787, a gallant little vessel, the Bounty, set out on a voyage of exploration and discovery for the dark, unknown waters of the great South Sea. Its commander, William Bligh, was a stern and righteous man and ruled his ship with a rod of iron. Nearing the almost legendary island of Tahiti, the Bounty sails a tropic sea, silver in the moonlight. The stars are close and golden against the sky. Roger Byam, midshipman, played by Franchotone, comes on deck to find the ship's lieutenant, Fletcher Christian, standing at the rail.
Looking for mermaids, Byam?
Watching the skies.
There's a star you've never seen before.
Why, that's the Southern Cross. At home, that star meant all this voyage to me. It's amazing what one expects.
I came to sea with the same notions.
How long did you keep them?
Well, I've never lost them. The gilt and glitter's worn off. But there's always the next voyage, the next boat, the next island.
Listen, Christian. Music at sea. I never imagined it could be so beautiful.
Master Arms, stop that infernal jamboree. It's worse than two cats on a fence.
Aye, aye, Captain Vicer. At once, sir.
The pernicious old death head. I never saw a better seaman, but as a man, he's a snake.
Hold it, Congress.
He doesn't punish for discipline. He likes to see men crawl. Sometimes I'd like to squeeze his poison down his own throat.
You both have one thing in common, the devil's own temper.
He can let his go. Whether I can keep mine bottled up for 2 years on this half a walnut is the question.
You know, this isn't easy to say, but I'm going to say it. I like you better than any man I've ever met. Whatever happens, I'll always be glad I've known you.
I'll remember that when you're an admiral.
You'd better get some rest, Christian.
I can't sleep.
Well, good night, then.
Good night. Wait by him.
Yes, Christian?
There's something you can do for me.
Gladly. What is it?
One never knows what may happen on a voyage like this. If for any reason I don't return to England, I'd like you to see my parents.
Why wouldn't you return to England?
I can't stand by and watch this devil's work much longer. One of these days, I'll lose my customary self-control and break Bly's neck.
Oh, you wait till we reach England. The Admiralty will save you the trouble.
In any case, I'd like you to see my parents.
Of course. Where do they live?
In Cumberland, at Mainclidere. I used to read in the old hall beneath the tapestry we had. Ships and islands on it. So I went to sea. Well, if anything happens, tell my father and mother that you knew me.
You may count on me.
Good, that's settled then.
Mr. Christian, Mr. Byam, you're up late.
Well, it's very warm below, Captain Bligh.
A true sailor can sleep in an oven if need be, or on a cake of ice. Get below.
And then the island of Tahiti. Its happy, golden-skinned natives untouched by civilization. Where we find Midshipman Byam carrying out his task of compiling a dictionary of the Tahitian language in the home of the native chief, Hidi Hidi. A home decorated, incidentally, by the chief's lovely granddaughter, Tahani.
Hidi Hidi, what's your word for money?
Byam, you will crack your head with thinking. Go swim with Tahani. Word's no good.
Oh, but money's a very important word.
Money? What is money?
I'll show you. Now, here I have a shilling in one hand and a nail in the other. Which would you choose?
I take nail.
Oh, no, Hidi Hidi. You could trade one of these shillings for 20 of the nails.
Huh? Where?
Well, in England. You see, in England, you must have money to live with, to buy food.
In Ireland of England, no fruit on trees, no fish in sea.
Oh, yes, plenty.
In England, no money, no food, eh?
That's right.
I stay here.
Belay, Tahani, take those flowers off my head. I like my flowers in a bowl. And put down that dictionary. Here, you little powder monkey. If you come across my hawse again, I'll spank your little starboard, you understand?
Yes.
Yes? But, Tahani, I didn't know you spoke English.
Yes?
Great guns, you must think me an awful fool.
Yes?
Hidi, does she speak English or not?
She speak English. One word. Yes.
Ye gods, a beautiful girl who knows only one word of English. Yes. What a country.
But soon paradise is astern, and driven by hunger and the cruelty of Bly, the half-starved crew mutinied. Back to Tahiti's golden strands and laughing girls go the mutineers. But eventually the long arm of England stretches out, and they are dragged back to Portsmouth Harbor. The day of their trial finally arrives, the 12th day of September 1792, aboard His Majesty's ship Duke in Portsmouth Harbor. Lord Hood is presiding.
Order in court. This hearing is resumed. Has any member of the court a question?
My lord, I should like to ask a question of Captain Bly.
Captain Bly. Proceed, Captain Nelson.
Captain Bly, when you were seized by armed men in your cabin, was this your first intimation of mutiny?
Yes, sir. But a circumstance occurred on the night before which should have aroused my suspicions. Going on deck, I found Fletcher Christian and the prisoner Byam talking together at the rail. I heard the prisoner Byam say, "You can count on me." I heard Christian reply, "Good, that's settled then." I saw them shake hands. Afterwards, I realized they were plotting a mutiny.
But that's not true, Captain Bly. My lord, gentlemen, let me explain.
The prisoner must confine himself to questioning the witness.
Captain Bly, you've not repeated all my talk with Fletcher Christian. Did you not hear him tell me that he was afraid you would never allow him to reach England alive?
I did not.
Well, did you not hear him ask my promise that if anything should happen to him, I would go to his father in Cumberland and tell him the truth?
I did not.
My lord, I swear before God in this court, that was the content of my talk with Fletcher Christian. It had nothing whatever to do with mutiny.
Silence! Silence! I must remind the prisoner to confine himself to questioning the witness.
My lord, I have nothing more to ask him. I can only say again to this court, I am not guilty of mutiny.
If that is true, why did you not join your captain when he was set adrift in the launch?
Sir, I was below deck planning a counterattack to regain the ship from the mutineers.
With whom did you plan this attack?
Sir, with my messmate, Midshipman Stewart.
Midshipman Stewart, is he here?
My lord, Midshipman Stewart died in the wreck of the Pandora.
Then there is no one who can testify as to your innocence?
No one, my lord.
Have you anything to say before judgment of the court is passed upon you?
My lord, much as I desire to live, I'm not afraid to die. Since I sailed on the Bounty over 4 years ago, I've known how men are made to suffer worse things than death. Cruelly. Beyond duty. Beyond necessity. Captain Bly, you've told your story of mutiny on the Bounty. How men plotted against you, seized your ship, cast you adrift in an open boat. A great venture in science brought to nothing. Two British ships lost. English seamen flung across the world, drowned or killed by savages. But there's another story, Captain Bly, of 2 cheeses and 10 coconuts, of a man who robbed his seamen, cursed them, flogged them, not to punish, but to break their spirit. A story of greed and tyranny and of anger against it, of what it cost. For one man, my lord, Fletcher Christian, would not endure such tyranny. That's why you hounded him, Captain Bly. That's why you hate him, hate his friends. And that's why you're beaten, Fletcher Christian, still free. But Christian lost too, my lord. We all lost on the Bounty. If Christian's alive, he's an outlaw, hiding in despair from his own countrymen. God knows he's judged himself more harshly than you can judge him. I tell you, he was my friend. No finer man ever lived. I do not seek to justify his crime, his mutiny, but I condemn the tyranny that drove him to it. You gentlemen know the uses of authority. You exact the law of the sea. But the letter of the law is one thing, the spirit's another. I do not speak here for myself alone, nor even for the seamen you condemned. I speak in their names, in Fletcher Christian's name, for all men at sea. These men do not ask for comfort. They do not ask for safety. If they could speak, they would say, "Let us choose to do our duty willingly. Not the choice of a slave, but the choice of free Englishmen. They only ask the freedom that England expects for every man, Oh, if one man among you believed that, one man, he might command the fleets of England. He might win the seas for England if he called his men to their duty not by flaying their backs, but by lifting their hearts. Their hearts, my lord. That's all.
The Magic Key of RCA brings us back from Hollywood, where French O'Tone appeared in a dramatic scene from Mutiny on the Bounty. Again, we are in Radio City, the home of the family of RCA. One of the outstanding personalities in modern music is the great violinist Ephraim Zimbalist. He has played in almost every large city in the world. He has established himself as a distinguished composer, and yet he remains the same unassuming, extremely modest artist that he was when he first played in America 24 years ago. He is now on tour in Europe. This afternoon, he is in Amsterdam, the Netherlands. The Magic Key of RCA turns across the Atlantic to Ephraim Zimbalist in Amsterdam.
Hello, America. This is Hilversum, from Holland, the Avro Studio calling. You will now hear Ephraim Zimbalist, the great violinist, with Theodor Seidenberg at the piano.
Thank you. The Magic Key turns to New York.
The Magic Key of RCA again turns to the thrilling soprano voice of Suzanne Fisher, the new Metropolitan Opera star. This time she sings a recitative and gavotte from the opera Manon.
Flanders fields, the poppies blow. Between the crosses, row on row, that mark our place. And in the sky, the larks, still bravely singing, fly, scarce heard, amid the guns below. We are the dead. Short days ago we lived, felt dawn, saw sunset glow, loved and were loved. And now we lie in Flanders fields. Take up our quarrel with the foe. To you from failing hands we throw the torch. Be yours to hold it high. If ye break faith with us who die, we shall not sleep, though poppies grow in Flanders fields.
This is John B. Kennedy speaking. At 11 o'clock on a gray, foggy morning 17 years ago tomorrow, trumpets blew through Armageddon. The order, cease firing, that halted battle between the greatest armed forces the world has ever known. The armistice had been signed. International hate died at that moment. A world was instantly spiritualized by a hope and belief that it would never happen again, and that some system of arbitration would be evolved to replace war. The World War had reached its climax. The turning point came at Chateau Thierry and Bellewood and Soissons. There, when the Allies were exhausted by the hammering of nearly 4 years, when the Grand Army of France had been pushed back to within 40 miles of Paris, when the Allied cause was shaken and almost shattered, the valiant youth of America arrived. Not far from Chateau Thierry, where a stone bridge crossed the Marne and joined the road to Paris, there ensued a 20-day savage battle, a fury of fighting that stopped the drive on Paris. The American Marines made their counteroffensive in and through the Belleau Wood. This action was under the command of a soldier with whose fame you are familiar and whom I am about to introduce. His success at these crucial points in place and time in the war brought him to the command of the Fighting 2nd Division of the AEF. Not long after the armistice, Marshal Ferdinand Foch, victorious generalissimo of the Allied and American armies, stood at that bridge of Chateau Thierry. He spoke to a group of us, this sturdy old soldier with the bandy figure, the ferocious mustache, and the twinkling glance. As he spoke, he mentioned two American names, praised their resolution and their courage. The two names he mentioned were those of General John J. Pershing, Commander-in-Chief of the AEF, and Major General James G. Harbord, Commander of the 2nd Division. Not only did these two men serve their country as soldiers, but both have carried on in public service, and both have contributed, through their writing, to the rich records of American history. General Pershing is now on his way back to America from a visit to the battlefields of France. General Harbord is here with us this afternoon. It is my honor to present General Harbord.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. On the eve of Armistice Day, it is a very real pleasure to be able to greet my old friends and comrades in action. Rather than make an address to you, I would like to read two messages, one from our great World War commander, General Pershing, and one from the French commander-in-chief, Marshal Pétain. From Marshal Pétain, who was the greatest living military figure in France, and held in affectionate remembrance by every man who served over there, I have received a radiogram within the hour in which he asked me to transmit his affectionate devotion to the veterans of the American Army. I'm sure that millions of Americans are glad to join an affectionate greeting to the Marshal on this eve of Armistice Day. From General Pershing, now on the steamship Washington, I have the following message. Will you please express my most cordial respects to the people of the United States? They, in their patriotic loyalty, inspired the devotion and relentless determination of our men and provided the means with which our armies were able to meet the crisis of a world conflict and emerge victorious. I want to give my warmest greetings and good wishes to my comrades of the World War. On this anniversary of the signing of the armistice, my memory is filled with the many occasions when their indomitable courage and unhesitating sacrifice brought honor to the American Expeditionary Forces and the Allied cause. I have just visited the plains of northern France with their thousands of well-kept white crosses. And while I plead against complacent optimism in international affairs, as unavoidable war may come when least expected, I believe it is our responsibility and the responsibility of our educators to train our youth for peace by developing in them the spirit of sportsmanship and goodwill toward the people of all lands. Observation of Armistice Day recalls the tremendous cost of life that we have paid for peace. It is my fondest hope that such a war will never happen again, and that understanding among nations may make permanent the peace and security so dearly won. Signed, John J. Pershing. America salutes you, General Pershing, and I may extend to you the heartfelt greetings of the nation you have served so faithfully, a nation that will forever remember your service in its hour of need. Thank you, General.